Christ.
Well, it's a garden, it's early in the morning, and it's still dark. A young woman has gone to the garden to go to a cave where the body of a loved one, a friend, was buried. And she comes to the cave, and remember, it's early in the morning, it's still dark, and it's clear that someone has been there before her. So someone's tampered with the entrance to the cave. And, you know, what do you do? What do you think in that situation? I think, you know, you think, what's happened? Who wants to muck around with a dead body? What kind of person is that? And I would think, early in the morning when it's still dark, you think, is that person still here somewhere? Is the person who did that behind the rock over there? And so she does what I would do. She sprints and runs back through the garden to the city, to the place where her friends are staying. And she says to them, they've taken the body. I don't know where they've taken him, and I don't know where to find him. And the two friends hear this, and they run toward the garden. And they go to the garden, they go to the cave. And the younger man, I guess he's faster, he gets there first, but he hesitates and stays outside the cave. And he sees that the kind of entrance has been tampered with. And he looks in, and he can see that the woman's thesis is correct. Someone's taken the body, because he can see the linen from the clothes around the body are there on the table in the cave. And then the older man, the other friend who gets there later, not as fit as the young guy, but he runs straight in, so not as fit, but braver, go old men. He runs in and he finds, again, yet there is no body in this cave. And he notices not only that the linen is there, but that the linen has been folded and separated. So there's the thing that would have been around the head, and that's up the top, and then there's the stuff that would have been around the torso, and that's down the bottom of the table. Now, what sense do you make of a scene like that? The woman's original thesis was right. The body's not there. And I think she jumps to, I think, the most rational conclusion you could. That is, someone's stolen the body. This story's from the ancient world. But in the ancient world, they are like us. If a body has moved and it's dead, the first reason is that someone else has done something to it, because dead bodies don't move themselves. That's her theory, and that seems reasonable. But then you start to think, so who wants this particular dead body? Now, a Jewish person, this is in a Jewish city, I don't think I'm surprising many people, you're going to get to the conclusion, but you probably guessed. In this Jewish city, Jewish people don't want to touch a dead body. It's going to make them unclean, and what does another person want to do with that dead body? But I think more disturbingly, if you want a dead body, why do you want it naked? So how does it serve your purposes to think, not only do I want a body, but I'm sufficiently invested in that body being naked that I'm going to take the clothes off it before I run out of this tomb? I don't think it helps your kind of standing in society to be, you know, there early in the morning, someone else is out for a jog, what are you doing, Bob? And he says, oh, just nothing, just going, it's a nice morning. And Bob, why have you got a dead naked body with you? And if you're the kind of person that steals dead, naked bodies, how likely is it that you're also the kind of person that goes into a tomb while it's still dark, gets the body, takes the clothes off, and just says, do we go? And your mate says, no, we're not going to go. We're criminals. We're not grots. And we're going to fold up the clothes and put them neatly to one side or the other of the table before we sprint out of here with this dead, naked body. That's the scene, and as no doubt you have guessed, that's the scene recorded from one of the early Christian accounts of the alleged resurrection of Jesus of Nazareth. And that's the thing that we wanted to think about here in the time that we've got tonight. And I wanted to issue these kind of three invitations to thinking about the meaning and significance of Easter: an invitation to know, an invitation to think, and an invitation to imagine. I want to issue an invitation to know, because there's stuff to know here. I'd love us to walk away knowing a bit more about the kind of the data that historians work with and the things that Christians believe. I want us to think together, an invitation to not only know the data, but to try to piece it together and do some kind of historical reasoning together. And finally, I want us to imagine. That is, I want to say, even if you're not a person who believes these things, I think it would be an investment to know what it's like to believe these things, to imagine what it would be to be someone who believed in the event that Christians mark at Easter. Does that make sense? That's the program. Knowing stuff, thinking stuff, and then imagining stuff. So firstly, I want to invite you to know. When we're talking about Easter and we're trying to think critically and reasonably about Easter, we're thinking about the claim that on the 3rd of April, 33 AD, now this is slightly annoying, or the 7th of April, 30 AD, we're doing ancient history and there are two options because Pontius Pilate is only in Judea for a short 9-year period. And so anyway, they're the two options and it's a bit boring to go into. But let's say the more likely one is the 3rd of April, 33 AD. Jesus of Nazareth is crucified under Pontius Pilate, death by crucifixion. And then 2 days later, the claim is that the tomb of Jesus is found empty. That's claim number one. And claim number two is that the disciples, his followers, one skeptic and one enemy, say that the risen Jesus has appeared to them. So they're the two bits of historical kind of data that we want to grapple with. We don't want to grapple with the fact that Jesus was crucified. That would be interesting for its meaning, but not particularly interesting because it's not controversial. The Jesus' death by crucifixion under Pontius Pilate, says Bart Ehrman, the great atheist New Testament scholar, is by far the most secure fact we have about Jesus. Completely uncontroversial, fascinating what it means, but uncontroversial as to whether it happened. So the interest and the controversy is over the empty tomb and the appearances to disciples. So we want to know this, and I guess the thing I want to say is, how do we know it and what do we know? We know this, like we know lots of things, because of evidence. We have evidence for it, but what sort of evidence do we have for it? And the answer, very importantly, is that the kind of evidence we have is historical evidence. Now, I want to labour that because the kind of evidence we don't have is scientific evidence. That is, that there's no one now at UWA doing experiments on dead Jewish bodies to see what happens to them if you put them in graves at sufficiently cool temperatures after crucifixion. The claim of Christians and the claim of the Bible is not that this is what happens under test conditions, but that in a particular instance, this is what happened. And so we're talking here about historical evidence, not scientific, but neither are we talking about religious or faith-based evidence. We're talking about something different again. The people that wrote about these things were, of course, religious. But when you're talking about ancient history, insert every other person you read here. Every person you read from the ancient world is religious. Every person you read from the ancient world is biased. Every person you read from the modern world is biased and has an agenda to push. You don't get anywhere in history by excluding religious people from your conversation. And actually, the kind of evidence we have is not of a religious event. It's a religiously significant event, but it's not presented in our sources as if a myth. A fascinating thing about the way the resurrection of Jesus or the alleged resurrection of Jesus is reported is how kind of unreligious it is. There's no account of the actual resurrection. There's just an empty tomb and appearances. It's not using the language of myth, but of history. It gives you time and dates and early in the morning and the names of people and places. None of that proves that it happened. But what it does do is moves us into thinking, how would you know that it happened? And it's not by intuition or faith or scientific experiment, but by the process of history and historical reasoning. Now, because we're in the realm of history here, we're talking about writing. History comes to us overwhelmingly through written documents, written sources, and that's what we need to deal with to investigate this question. Now, the question is, a question that's often asked is, do we have non-Christian sources about Jesus? And the answer to that is actually yes. There are a number of non-Christian writers, Jewish and Greek and Roman, who write about Jesus. And Jesus generates the kind of literary impact that you would expect of a minor, non-office-bearing prophet from a provincial part of the Roman Empire. That is, not tons, not nothing. He was noticed. He caused a stir in Jerusalem. He generated a bunch of followers, and he had the kind of non-Christian testimony that you would expect from that sort of thing. But to be honest and to be like as transparent and fair as possible, most of the data about the resurrection of Jesus comes from the Bible. And so I wanted to say two things about the Bible as a source. The first thing to say is that the Bible is not a source. The Bible is a whole ton of sources. We use the word Bible to describe what is essentially a library that you can conveniently carry around. But it is a library. It's not written by one person. It's written by many people, and it's pulled together for convenience, but it was no one's plan to pull it together. It's a library that's pulled together in a codex. So when we say the Bible, that doesn't mean we're talking about one source. And in the case of the topic under consideration tonight, which is the alleged resurrection of Jesus, you have four Gospels, four biographies of Jesus, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, and you have the testimony of Paul, which we come to in a moment. So you have multiple sources on this topic, and more impressive but also slightly confusing and disconcerting, within those sources you have sources. So the writer Luke, who writes one of the Gospels, begins his Gospel by saying many people have attempted to write up the thing that I'm writing up. And so he clearly understands that there are other sources available, and those sources have been used by the writers of the Bible to come to their conclusions. This is a map we can come to later about how those sources may have worked with Mark, Q, L, and M, which is what scholars talk about as the sources that the writers of the New Testament use. We can come to that at the end. We won't worry about that now. The second thing that you want, if you're talking about history, is you not only want sources, you want multiple sources, and we have that, so we can start doing history together. But secondly, you want sources that corroborate with each other. The thing you don't want, if you've got two sources and one of them says Caesar crossed the Rubicon and the other one says Caesar did not cross the Rubicon, then historically you're in trouble. And you start to think to yourself, well, which one's older, which one's more reliable, which one, and so on. But if they're both of the same vintage with the same kind of prestige, then you get to a point where there's not much you can do about that. You want corroboration. You want people to be able to say, this guy says that Caesar crossed the Rubicon, and so does this guy. You want corroboration, but you don't want collaboration. See, the other thing you don't want, you want corroboration on the facts, but you don't want the guy who says Caesar did and the guy who says Caesar didn't say, hey, before we publish, let's get in a room together, iron out our differences, and then go live and just keep a stiff upper lip about our differences. Historians don't want that, because historians are impressed when there are discrepancies, when there are arguments, when there are people coming at these things from different angles. And so while that may be good for them saving face, a historian looks at that and thinks, you've kind of ruined it for me, because I could have had two sources, but now I've just got one source because you guys have presented this kind of united front to the world, and I want more than that if I'm going to think historically. The gold standard is corroboration, same facts, without collaboration, without people getting together and colluding. And the good news is we've got that. In a way that can be sometimes disconcerting if you're a Christian, the sources that we have sit awkwardly with each other. Was it still dark or had the sun come up? Was there one man? Was there one angel? Were there two angels? Were they wearing normal clothes? Were they wearing white? Who got there first? How many women were there? Did Jesus appear in Jerusalem or Galilee? What happened? If you read your New Testament and read these sources, there are things that are kind of awkward to think, how do these fit together? And so if you're coming at that from a particular Christian understanding, that can be like a bit confusing. But if you're coming from that as a historian, it's terrific. Because historians look at that and think, great, you didn't get in a room together and make sure you all were on the same page. And it makes the testimony that's available to us in the Bible wildly more trustworthy to know that they didn't collude. My PhD thesis is in the ancient history department, and it's about an ancient historian, but it's his biography. So in actual fact, my field is modern Australian history. And I wanted to share this little story with you. It only kind of surfaced a few weeks ago, but it's kind of a boring topic, but I think it's an interesting conclusion. The boring topic is that my thesis is about a Australian New Testament scholar and church leader. And one of the interesting things, he was in the Anglican Diocese of Sydney. So the Anglicans had all bunched together in Sydney. And in the history of Christianity in that particular tradition in Sydney, the way the clergy preached changed between 1950 and 1960. So up until 1950, the clergy all preached with a certain methodology. And then in the 1960s, they all changed and adopted another methodology. That makes sense? So you've got a before and an after. And the story is that in 1958, a guy called John Chapman, who was a leader in that scene, went and heard an English preacher called John Stott, who showed them the new method. They learned the new method, and he went off and his friend and taught everyone else, and the whole thing changed, right? About 50 years ago, except that's almost certainly not right. That's what John Chapman said in his oral memory, which was recorded, and his first biographer said that was the case, that it was 1958. But actually, if you look at the evidence, it was almost certainly 1965. And what had happened is that it seems that this guy, great, and like certainly not trying to mislead anyone, had got confused about two different events and two different conversations and kind of conflated them in his mind. And that was like 45, 50 years ago. And there's this little thing in Australian historiography, and here's the point, that's what you expect in history. If you're getting multiple attestations, if you're getting different sources to corroborate this kind of stuff, you expect there to be these little kinks and iron out. And you know what? No one's conclusion is that it never happened. Certainly this guy came. Certainly that caused a new way of preaching in the Diocese of Sydney. And certainly this guy was involved in implementing it. It doesn't raise a question about whether, in fact, it encourages the historian to say there's stuff here to work with. Does that make sense? Okay. I wanted to share with you a source. We're talking about the source. I want to show you one of these sources. It's from the Apostle Paul. And I want to explain that because Paul is a weird person to choose because he didn't write a gospel. And so why are we talking about the Apostle Paul, the early Christian missionary? And there's three reasons why historians love Paul. The first one is that he's early. So the gospels, we guess, are about 40 to 50 years after the events that they record. Whereas Paul is writing about 20 years after the events that are recorded. So Paul gets you closer to Jesus, and historians rate closeness highly. Paul is close, but secondly, and perhaps even more importantly, Paul is disinterested. That is to say, all the other guys set out to write biographies. If you ask Luke halfway through, what are you doing? He would say, I'm writing a biography of Jesus because I want you to know what happened. Whereas Paul never wrote a biography of Jesus. He wrote letters. And in these letters, he was just trying to explain to people that they shouldn't be getting drunk at communion and they should be like treating each other better than they are. He wrote pastoral letters. And so accidentally and incidentally, he includes information about Jesus. It's actually one of the things in the case I was talking about earlier, the thing that alerted people to the fact that this date and this time was wrong was that someone wrote a biography of the English preacher. And this person had no reason to corroborate the evidence in Sydney, and they verified that it was 1965 rather than 1958. And Paul's like that. He's not trying to set the record straight. He's got other purposes, but he accidentally gives us the best information we've got. And thirdly, Paul is an eyewitness. He's someone who saw the risen Jesus, and he wrote down what he saw. He didn't see him in the same way and in the same time as the early guys, but he saw Jesus and was received by the other guys as someone who had seen him. Someone cruelly said that my kids must have did this, but I did this. So the passage we're going to look at is Paul from the book of 1 Corinthians, the first letter to the Corinthians, which was written in about 54 AD. And the events that he's talking about happened in 33 AD. But as you'll see, Paul is quoting from traditions that are right up against the events that we're talking about. So I'll show it to you now. This is the Apostle Paul, and he says, What I delivered to you as of first importance is what I also received, that Christ died for our sins in accordance with the Scriptures, that he was buried, that he was raised on the third day in accordance with the Scriptures, that he appeared to Cephas, then to the 12, then he appeared to more than 500 brothers at one time, most of whom are still alive, though some have fallen asleep. Then he appeared to James, then to all the apostles. And last of all, he appeared as to one untimely born. He appeared also to me. Now, look at that. You see the thing, first of all, that I said. See how he says, what I delivered to you in, he says, in 54 AD, he writes to them, so this is a couple of years earlier, he himself had received. That is, he is quoting things that he heard way back then from the other apostles. That make sense? He's quoting what he received. And what he received, notice what kind of literature this is. This isn't inspiring. This isn't someone saying, and lo, did he descend from on high and did he break forth from the tomb and, you know, defeat Satan and his enemies and then raise us all up to glory. Do you see what kind of language this is? It's careful people getting together and say, let's not forget what happened. First it was on the third day, then it was him, then was it James? Oh, it was James, and then it was that, and then there were the 500. It's almost like a police report, carefully making sure that these facts aren't lost. It's actually written in a way not to be sung, but to be memorized, so that you could go out and keep the record straight as you preached and taught the gospel. And notice that detail of the 500 in line 6. Then he appeared to more than 500 brothers at one time, most of whom are still alive, though some have fallen asleep. Why do you think he wants you to know that some of the people that saw, or that most of the people that saw Jesus are still alive? I think it's because he's inviting you to ask them. That this is not a dreamtime myth. This is not an ancient fable about the dying and rising sun god or something like that. This is a thing where people are alive at the time and he invites you to check with them. Well, that's the kind of data that we're dealing with, historical written text. I want to try and think with you now about what these could possibly mean. Jesus of Nazareth, crucified in Jerusalem under Pontius Pilate. His disciples report appearances that begin 3 days after he had died. He appears also to his enemy, Paul, on the road to Damascus a little while later. And the word that the early Christians universally use for that experience is that Christ was raised, that he had been resurrected from the dead. So we're doing historical reasoning together. We have an historically secure claim that the early disciples claim that Jesus had been raised from the dead. That in itself, I think, is beyond refutation, that that's what they believed happened. But here's where we're going to think as historians. The question that historians ask is, what caused that belief? You think normally that history is what happened, but history is not really what happened. History is what caused what happened. What historians are really interested in, academic historians, is not that there was a World War II, but what caused World War II. Not that there was a crossing of the Rubicon, but what was Caesar doing as he crossed the Rubicon? Why did the British colonize India? What happened? The why of history is what caused these things. And I think that the best way to approach this question is to say we've got a historically secure fact. The Christians believed in the resurrection of Jesus. What caused that belief? That makes sense as a question? So the first thing you have to ask about is background. Maybe the thing that caused that belief is the expectation that it would happen. But here's the first puzzle of Jesus. No one expected this to happen. Like in the ancient world, if you look at the Greco-Roman literature, that is the non-Jewish outside the Bible literature, there's all sorts of traditions about what happens to the dead, that their souls go to heaven, that they go to Hades, that nothing happens, that they're reincarnated. There are all sorts of options available for pagan belief about what happens to dead people, and resurrection wasn't one of them. There was no tradition. There were people who were resuscitated by magicians and so on. But the idea that someone would be raised to new life in their body just wasn't on the table in ancient paganism. And here's the second thing. It was sort of on the table in the Jewish world, but in a particular way. First thing is that the Jews weren't uniform on this. So groups like the Sadducees did not believe in the resurrection of the dead. They believed that once you died, that was it. Groups like the Pharisees did believe in the resurrection of the dead, and there's some believe that all people would be raised from the dead. Others believe that only the righteous would be raised from the dead. But of those Jewish people who did believe in the resurrection, none of them expected someone to rise in history. All resurrecting in all Jewish thought was happening at the end of time. It was on no one's job description in the ancient world to be raised from the dead. You see this actually if you read the Gospels, that the Gospels are full of allusions and scripture of saying that Jesus died and it was like this and it was like that, and there's all these allusions, and suddenly when you hit the resurrection accounts, all the biblical allusions fall away because no one knows what to do with it. Because it was on no one's job description to be raised from the dead in history. So if it's no one's job description, there's no background case to expect this would happen. You can kind of work that out because there were lots of messiahs at the time, and if your messiah died, your movement finished. Whereas if you were expecting the messiah to rise again, of course you'd say my guy, Weekend at Bernie's style, if you remember that 80s film. But no one did that before the Christians. So background, no. Would the appearances be sufficient to cause the belief in the resurrection of Jesus? Would it be enough to say, well, these guys, their guy died, and then they started seeing him again, and that's what caused that belief? I think, again, the answer to that question is no. You see, then as now, people, especially grieving people, often see their loved ones again. In visions, in dreams, in very real experiences, people in grief will see the person that they lost. But you see, in the time and in the evidence that we've got, that's not the way they describe their experience. There's a language available to the ancient Jews, to the Jews of the first century, to describe visions and hallucinations and dreams and encounters with ghosts and stuff, and that's not the language they use. They talk about Jesus was anastasis. That's the first word, that he stood up again, that he was lying down and then he stood up, or the ageiro word, to rise up, to wake up. It's like a body was on a bed and then the body stood up again. Typically here they'll say, he was raised from among the dead. You're supposed to picture dead bodies everywhere, and then this one guy stands up among the dead bodies. They didn't use the language of hallucination or vision, but the language of resurrection. I put it to you that the appearances alone would not be enough, and certainly not everyone that saw Jesus was grieving. So of some of the appearances that had, Paul was an enemy of Jesus. He wasn't feeling guilty at all. He was on his way to kill Christians. And the risen Jesus appeared to him. Thomas was a skeptic, and the risen Jesus appeared to him. And he appeared to over 500 at one time. Very hard to coordinate a group hallucination like that. Very hard to enter into someone else's dream. So I put it to you, thirdly, that the only way we can account for what caused this early belief is the combination of the empty tomb and the appearances. I think that would do it. If people believe that the tomb was empty, then you get people standing up again. And if you believe that you'd seen Jesus again, that would do the trick. That would be good historical reasoning. But here's the other question. Could you account for an empty tomb and resurrection appearances without resorting to resurrection? And the answer to that, I think, is obviously yes. There's all sorts of ways you could have an empty tomb and resurrection appearances. You could have that situation, for example, if Jesus didn't die. So if Jesus didn't die, if he was on the cross, you thought he was dead, he wasn't, he went into the tomb, he came out again, you've got both. You've got an empty tomb because he wasn't really dead, and you've got appearances because he's wandering around. Or you could have a mistaken tomb. Therefore, you've got these grieving people who are cruising around. Someone goes to the wrong tomb, says Jesus isn't there, and then their grief-stricken appearances of the risen Jesus fit with an apparently empty tomb, although it was a mistake. Or someone stole the right body from the right tomb and they got there too late and they found it empty. Again, that would deliver what you need. Or maybe it wasn't really Jesus on the cross, but someone that looked like him. Or maybe he had a twin and the twin was seen wandering around Jerusalem and everyone's like, what is that? And was that him? And you know, like, you see your random friend's twin and it's confusing. Maybe that could kind of deliver the result. You could get an empty tomb and appearances. But then again, think critically for a moment. How likely are those explanations? They're possible. Are they probable? It's the question of history. So take, for example, the idea that Jesus didn't die. That's possible. Is it probable that Jesus, after being bashed all night, after being crucified at 9 a.m. by professional Roman executioners, is it probable that he wasn't really dead, although that was their job? That they stabbed him in the side and water and blood came out and they put him in a tomb. And in a tomb without medical attention or help or food or water of any kind, he revived strong enough to move a stone from a door, and such that when people saw him again, they didn't say, you look rough, but you look like you've been resurrected. It's possible, but not probable. Or how likely is it that they got the wrong tomb or the body was stolen? Again, who wants the body? For what purposes? Why the linen? Why is that body not produced later? Why are people starting to die for their faith? And someone doesn't say, oh, guys, just to be honest, you're going to come around and see what's in the back of my place and we really should stop this now. Why was it never, you know, or the resurrection, you know, the appearances to 500 people, to skeptics, to enemies? The question is not, is it possible? All those things are possible, but thinking historically, how probable are they? You might remember in 2002, there was an Australian skater called Steve Bradbury. Everyone remember this guy? So he's Australian, and just by virtue of being an Australian at the Winter Olympics, he was coming last in the event that he was in, which was the speed skating, and just, you know, like very comfortably last, and just skating along, and then suddenly every other person in the race falls over, and I just love the look on his face. I think that's how I looked on my wedding day. Just, I do not deserve this, and somehow here I am. And that was it. And so you see, he just, like, everyone else fell over and he was the last man standing. And I think the Christian explanation of what happened in 33 AD in Jerusalem is a bit like Steve Bradbury. It's so preposterous that someone would be raised from the dead, except every other explanation just keeps kind of falling over. And then at the end, you've got this thing that is seemingly absurd, but you're confronted with this thing that there he is, or there it is. The claim that Jesus has been raised from the dead. I do think there is a powerful case against the resurrection of Jesus, though. I think there's a case that is powerful, and it is so powerful that if you believe it, it would sweep out everything we've said today, and you could walk away comfortable and secure in not accepting the argument that I've given to you. I reckon the knockdown argument against the resurrection of Jesus is that there's no God to do the resurrecting. Because if there's no God to raise Jesus from the dead, then guess which the best explanation is? Anything. Anything is better. Take your pick, swoon, or just mix them all together. Anything's better than that if there is no God to raise Jesus from the dead. But do you know what? When it comes to the resurrection of Jesus, that's not a bug, that's a feature. Because the resurrection of Jesus is supposed to precipitate the question of God. It's not an accident, it's by design. Because the Christian claim is that God has stepped into history, done something in our history that in good faith we can investigate and know and believe. So know, think, and finally imagine. I want to ask the question as we finish, is not just, is it true, but is it sweet? That was how we started, that's how we advertised, sweet 16, what Easter means to me. And it may be that you've come with us and you think that's like persuasive or at least possible. It might be that you haven't come with us and thought, I don't really care or I don't buy it. I wanted to end just with a couple of minutes to ask the more sympathetic question, what would it look like to believe this? In 21st century Perth, in a human life, what kind of difference would it make? So I want to come back with you to that scene in the garden. That was from the Gospel of John, and we left that scene with the older man in the tomb, with the younger man outside of the tomb, discovering the linen and the table. But then John, the great storyteller, his camera goes back out of the tomb and over to the side in the garden. And in the way John tells the story, John's telling history, but he's also doing theology. He's also wanting to bring out the meaning of what happened. And so the camera comes out of the tomb and focuses on the woman. And she's alone in a garden and she's weeping. And then someone comes up to her and says, why are you weeping? Who are you looking for? And according to John, she says, she thinks he's the gardener. And she says to him, if you know where the body is, show me and I will go and get him. And then the apparent gardener says to her, Mary, and she says, Rabbi. Now, think about that scene for a moment. You've got a man, you've got a woman standing alone in a garden. Does that ring any bells? You see, the whole story of the Bible begins with a man and a woman in a garden. It begins with Adam and Eve standing together in a garden created by God and made ready by God to be the image bearers of God, to be to the creation what God is to the cosmos, to be a recognition to all created things of the goodness of God in heaven. And that went horribly wrong. And according to the Bible, our ability to serve God and know God and image God to the creation came wildly broken and unstuck. And then as John tells the story, on the last day of God's creative work, that is on the fifth day, Jesus stands before Pontius Pilate and Pontius Pilate says, behold the man. Just as God had said in the first garden, here is the man, here is Adam. And then on the Sabbath, he rests in his tomb. And then on the first day of the week, he comes out of his tomb and he's there with a woman in the garden. And you see what it means? That God has begun his work of recreation. That in the resurrection of Jesus, God has kick-started the creation again. God has decided not to abandon us, but to give us hope that Jesus would be, as the Apostle Paul says, the first fruits from among the dead. You look out over an orchard and the whole thing is kind of barren, middle of winter or whatever, and it's the summer fruit and you look and there's nothing. And then one day you wake up and suddenly there's the first fruit, and the first fruit's there, but the first fruit is not alone. It's the promise of the coming harvest. And the meaning of the resurrection of Jesus is that he's the first fruit of the coming harvest. That what God did for Jesus, he's going to do for those who trust in Jesus. And he's going to redeem and restore the whole creation. And Jesus is the kickstart to that. Thank you very much for your time and attention tonight. I think Paul will tell us what to do next. Thank you. Oh, sorry.